Welcome to the Pair Program from Hatchpad, the podcast that gives you a front row seat to candid conversations with tech leaders from the startup world. I'm your host, Tim Winkler, the creator of Hatchpad.
And I'm your other host, Mike Ruin.
Join us each episode as we bring together two guests to dissect topics at the intersection of technology, startups, and career growth. So we are back to the Pair Program. Tim Winkler here with Mike Gruen. Mike, we are celebrating 2 years, my friend, of running the pod. It's a pretty long journey. I didn't think we would make it past month one or two, but here we are. So I wanted to ask you, you know, what's been like your most satisfying part of being a part of the podcast, or what's been your favorite part?
I mean, my favorite part is just meeting people. I like networking. I like hearing what's going on in the world, especially in the world of tech and stuff like that. So just the connections I've made, it's been a great opportunity for that and a great opportunity just to hear other people's perspectives. I've learned a lot. And what's funny is I find that I tend to just listen for a lot of the podcasts. Yeah. People probably notice, like, I try not to talk too much and let our guests talk. So yeah, it's been great. It's been a great opportunity.
Yeah, that's cool.
I appreciate you including me.
Oh yeah, no worries. We'll send you the invoice here shortly. I'd say like that's definitely part of it, but I also enjoy just like from the pairings perspective, you get like good recommendations or like ideas of like, oh, I never thought about mixing, you know, a mezcal Manhattan together or something like that. It's like it's a lot of alcohol recs come through, guys. Just a heads up on the pairings. Usually like good alcohol, good food recs, but I've enjoyed that, and then obviously getting to know some interesting people. We'll kick things off here for today's episode. So we're going to be continuing this theme of tech modernization within the government space, and specifically for this episode, like where software innovation intersects with defense, and taking full advantage of our pair program format, where we have two guests in every episode. We're going to dissect this a specific use case where, you know, a software company, Second Front Systems, is collaborating with AFWERX, you know, an innovation arm of the United States Air Force. So our first guest is Enrique Oti, CTO of Second Front Systems. So Enrique brings a rich background of dual use tech development, 23-year U.S. Air Force career, founding Kessel Run program, and co-founding a Defense Innovation Unit to pioneering accelerated access to emerging technologies in cyber and beyond for a lot of national security missions. A heck of a resume. Thanks for joining with us, Enrique.
No, and thanks for the invite. Really love getting on here talking to you guys. And anytime I get a chance to talk to Chi again, it's always fun. So
should be for good fun. Sure. For sure. And so on that, yeah, we alongside Enrique, we're joined by Donald Chi Gansberger, known as Chi. So he's the software director at AFWERX, master sergeant with over two decades in the Air Force. She is dedicated to elevating airmen's innovative ideas into actionable solutions for the Air Force. And a few other fun facts I dug up on you, Chi, that you're passionate about open wheel racing, brewing, and cooking. So you're my kind of guest on here. We'll definitely have some interesting add-on questions here to close with the 5 second scramble segment. But appreciate you joining us as well.
That's fun.
Cool. All right. Well, now, before we dive into the heart of the discussion, we always kick things off with our Pair Me Up segment. Mike, why don't you lead us off, my man?
Yeah, definitely. Not a food one or alcohol, sadly. But in any event, earlier this week, I had the opportunity through a community that I'm part of called TechEat to lead a discussion around trust. And my pairing is related to that, which is there's these like two concepts or two aspects of trust. Confidence, like that the people around you can do their job, they're going to play their position, they're going to get stuff done, they're reliable, and so on and so forth. And then this other aspect of trust, which is really around safety, that you feel comfortable making mistakes, that you feel like you're supported by your team, and how those two things go together and balance each other out and can create a lot of trust, and how you get a really great team out of that. So it was really interesting to have a whole discussion around that, and how you can sort of have one of those and not the other. Like, a baseball team might not have that sort of psychological, emotional trust, but they all know that they're all playing the right positions and so on and so forth. But when you can get both of those things, just how awesome that can be and how powerful it is, especially like on an engineering team. So yeah, so that's my pairing.
Yeah, well said. Thanks. Dig that. You've been getting deep lately. I'll lighten it up a little bit with my pairing. So I'm gonna, you know, the weather's kind of changing and spring's upon us. It's heating up. You know, a lot of folks are out there kind of cleaning up the golf clubs, gearing up for the season. So I'm gonna go with a sports pairing, a golfer and their caddy. So I think it's an interesting combination. It's a duo where you kind of have, you know, strategy meets skill. So, you know, the golfer swings, the other's kind of like strategizing, but together they come up with like this really unique game plan to attack the course. And I think it's a really interesting partnership in sports. So I'm going with a sports pairing with a golfer and the caddy. So
pretty cool.
Yeah. Let's pass it over to the guest. Let's start with you, Enrique. Quick intro on your pairing.
Enrique Oti. So on a pairing, you want me to actually be deep and philosophical and come up with a paired concept right now? Yeah.
It doesn't have to be deep or philosophical. You could legit go with
butter and bananas. I'm gonna
basically lay out for you. I have a private little urge here that is really embarrassing. Whenever I travel, I actually like listening to things like The Voice and X Factor, which is ridiculous, but it's like the most mind-numbing thing to like to watch those. But something that actually came out of that as I listen is like there's a massive overlap with concepts of risk and inspiration. So you look at these people, these like radical amateurs that just like jump up on stage and sing. Like you may never hear these people again, but they did one thing at one moment in time. And for 3 minutes, they did something. You're like, oh my God, that's freaking amazing. And these things have like 10, 20, 30 million views of this like 3 minutes in one person's life that is probably going to live on forever. And you look at it going like, you know, if you really want to be inspirational, you have to take risks. And like, it's incredible what can come out of that. I realize that's stupid, but for some reason that's been in my mind now for like weeks as I travel. I'm like, who's this crazy like 15-year-old kid who just like sang their heart out for 3 minutes? I'm like, that's pretty damn cool. So it's kind of inspiring. So there you go.
Yeah, I dig that. I'll give you a chair turn for that pairing. Yeah. That was good. Are you watching this season? I dabble every once in a while, but again, it's good. It's like mindless, kind of like have it in the background.
I have no idea what the seasons even are. I just literally like click The Voice on YouTube and see what kind of goes down that rabbit hole. So I'm like, we're Bulgarian something or other. It's
great. Well played. Good stuff. Chi, quick intro and your pairing.
Chi Gansberger. I'm a eclectic. I've definitely had an interesting career that's brought me to this point. Don't need to go into detail on that. But my pairs probably I keep noticing at every different, whether it's office I'm in or program I'm working on, it seems like there's false dichotomies all over the place where everybody is getting pulled into like one extreme or another, and even inter-organizational. And it's funny because Mike's pairing, I think, kind of plays well into it in that there's a disconnect between how people think of their focus or their goals relative to what everybody else around them is doing. And I'm watching it now where, whether it's politics, and I don't mean like national politics, I just mean like office politics, or whether it be like when I was an operator between the strategic side, the tactical side, or acquisitions, and you get into the, you know, the money side versus the requirement side. And it's these people, they've got their own tribe and their own mentality, and getting that mentality to kind of shift views has been really, really difficult. If anything, like when I met Enrique and we were at DIU, I was at my wit's end in terms of my career in the military.
Before, after you
I'd
met
gone
me.
From being an operator on stuff. Suddenly I was in acquisitions and I absolutely did it. And then I went out to DIU and it was like, oh, there's a chance to actually change things. And it turns out that's really hard, really, really hard, but it's kind of worth doing. But it's just opened that back up to me. Now I work with like people that are so insanely brilliant, and I love them, but I'm watching them run up to the same false dichotomies, whether it be political or something else. So I think that's probably right there.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I feel like those are themes that kind of pop up throughout a lot of our discussions with guests on this podcast. Is, you know, kind of dives into a little bit more of like specifics of like the culture too at every organization, and then you can get more granular with that of like the different tech culture and everything else. But yeah, I think that's a fascinating point. And, you know, I'd love to hear a little bit more about, you know, kind of like the theme over at AFWERX too, which is what we'll jump into and learn a little bit more on this discussion. So let's go ahead and make that transition point into the heart of what we want to talk about. So the way I kind of envision this discussion flowing would be, you know, having both of you kind of paint a quick picture on what, you know, what your organizations do. And then we can lead into, you know, what specifically Second Front Systems is delivering to AFWERX. And then I, you know, can dissect a little bit more on like the different aspects on the software delivery and the implementation process. Chi, why don't you begin first by maybe explaining, you know, what, for a lot of our listeners that aren't cued into the defense space, you know, what AFWERX stands for, you know, the mission, and then we can pass to you, Enrique, and dive deeper into work that Second Front's delivering.
So yeah, AFWERX is a fairly large organization. At this point, we've got four kind of core pieces of the team, and the public facing portion of AFWERX, the folks out there in the civilian sector, they probably think of ventures when they think of AFWERX, which is the cyber arm, and they go out and actually execute, you know, the largest cyber portfolio in the federal government, and which is quite a bit of money and a lot of contracts. The other portions of AFWERX are Spark, which is actually where I started in AFWERX. And it looks at fostering innovation internally in the Air Force, get that innovation mindset all the way down to the airmen, and help airmen actually mature good ideas. These are the small R requirements that are actually important, and they solve those problems better than anybody else. But there's no infrastructure for helping them mature those solutions up to the broader, more political levels through the POs. So that's Spark, and then Prime, which is where I live now. It exists as a, it started as a tech transition organization. Didn't really do a lot of that. And then the last couple of years, we actually looked back at say small UAS, which were invented in California. And then we promptly let the federal government screw up the legislation around small UAS, especially the FAA. And we promptly exported that entire market to China. And we realized, like, we're not going to make that mistake again with flying cars. So stood up an organization inside Prime called Agility Prime, which has spent hundreds of millions of dollars over the last few years maturing that technology and getting the technology for flying cars ready to go. Now we're to the point where FAA has become the problem again. And the cynic in me is like, oh, well, this probably isn't going to work out as well as we thought. But we did our part. We got the tech to where it needs to be. It's at the policy level where we're running into problems. The fourth one is new and is like our, it's an internal organization, but it's intelligence. And this actually gets into our relationship with Second Front. When CBER looked at not being renewed 2 years ago in Congress and had us all panicking and freaking out that we were all going to have to get new assignments and all the civilians were going to get let go and contractors would be gone, because what is AFWERX without CBER? And the do outs for it were two things. One was go do better assessments of these companies, making sure we're not incidentally funding Chinese venture capital and enabling tech transfer. And Enrique and I know Dr. Brown well, who wrote a great paper on it when we were back at DIU, making sure that doesn't become a recurring theme and that we're not funding it through AFWERX. The other thing that we did, though, is we looked at how hard it was to support those airmen with anything. Congress looked at us and said, your transition numbers are horrible. You've spent over $1 billion a year on CBERS. How many of them actually make it to a phase three, make it to transition to, you know, to the government or to the commercial sector? And the numbers are pretty small. I said, go fix that. Turns out that's really hard to fix for hardware. But all the intent for software was ATOs. And Second Front had a program with DIU that we could just leverage and pull it into AFWERX and say, hey, look, this is a great way to actually enable, whether it be small businesses from, through the Cyber portfolio or airmen who are developing things, to rapidly go get an ATO and fix that huge problem for us. And then, of course, Enrique and I let the good idea fairies flow, and we decided to extend SecOps out to the edge. Now this has turned into a totally insane thing, but I'm loving it. That part's way more fun.
I think what I learned the most is that we really had a missed opportunity for a pairing of government and acronyms. So just
oh, I'm the worst. I'm sorry. We'll
have to put some show notes together for all those acronyms, Tim.
Yeah, nothing we're not used to. It's no, kind of common practice at this point, but that's interesting. I don't think I realized how robust, how many programs were kind of happening across AFWERX, and with the kind of collaboration with Second Front, it sounds like it was just right time, right place. Obviously a good connection there, past performance in terms of, you know, knowing one another and having that trust. Enrique, maybe just kind of build a little bit more on Second Front, and then we can start to dig a little bit more into how this implementation took place.
Yeah, so Second Front has actually been around since about 2014. And in its early days, it was founded by two former Marines who were basically like, why are we going into combat with technology that's not much better than our adversaries, but our tech at home is awesome? And so they're like, how do you transition the best of Silicon Valley? Again, when I say Silicon Valley, it's the broad like tech ecosystem. Like, how do you transition the best of Silicon Valley into government? And Second Front at the time tried consulting. They tried building some applications that help with the acquisitions process. But at the end of the day, through this, a couple years of exploration, the company really figured out, you know, you have two roadblocks to getting really good tech in a government. One is the contracts. And the other is the security accreditation. Well, you're not going to solve the contracts. Like, there have been commission after commission on how to do acquisition reform, tons of new methodologies for contracting. And at the end of the day, people like DIU and AFWERX and others are trying to solve that. So the company really in like 2020, 2021, which I joined in 2020, we decided to pivot. We're like, you know, we're not going to help the government buy stuff better. Like, we can't. But we can help them secure it better. We can actually let them go faster on the cybersecurity piece, so they can actually make use of these products that they buy. Because, you know, we have a lot of use cases or examples of the government putting somebody under contract with a cyber. We paid them $1 million, $1.5 million. They've been under contract for 2 years and they never get accredited. But what that means is they were never used. So in other words, the government just spent over $1 million on nothing. And sure, one time, okay, that's bad. But when you start doing this thousands of times, you look at a nearly $1 billion cyber budget that most of it's going to stuff that it never gets transitioned. Actually, not even transition. Most of it never gets used. And that's even worse. And so we're like, well, how do we solve this? How do we make it better? How do we reduce that friction? Because in reality, there's friction on both sides. For those small innovators, this may be their only time ever working with the government. They've never filled out accreditation paperwork. They don't know who to talk to. They don't know what the acronyms mean either. They're looking those up on Google saying, what does this mean that the government's asked me for this? And so for them, it is an extremely painful process. And these are small companies having to hire outside consultants to help them just fill out paperwork. But on the other side, the government, you know, it's just as bad. The security officials on the government, poor dudes and women, they are overworked, underpaid. And what happens is, like, their users, like their operational end users, like annoying people like Chi, Chi is an operator, but he's also a technologist. So they come going, oh my God, I need these 15 apps. Those accreditors don't want to deal with that. They don't want their users coming to him saying, I want these 100 different commercial apps, because they're like, I don't have time. So they end up just saying no. And it's not because they want to say no. They say no because they just don't have time to look at 100 different commercial companies. So we, in many ways, provide that kind of that matching mechanism inside, which is commercial companies come to us, we help them through the process, we provide them tooling to do it. So it's not just filling out paperwork. We do the tools for it. But then the government, they've already accredited us one time. They can look at us and go, oh yeah, we trust that 90% of the tech stack. Now we only have to look at that top little layer that's the application itself. So it actually makes the process easier for the accreditors as well. So really, at the end of the day, everybody's happier, but more importantly, the tools get to the end user, which is actually what we all care about.
Enrique, I'm curious, because so back in, 2014-ish. I went through that process. I was at a company. We're trying to get our stuff through that accreditation. And we did the same thing. We had our own internal people. We hired a couple consultants. We had this, we had that. One of the biggest friction points for us was that the security requirements as written were less less secure than what we were actually doing. We were above what was in the documentation, but the people we were dealing with, you know, I'm not going to take anything away from them, but like, they're like, well, no, you're not blah, blah, blah compliant because you're not using one of these encryption algorithms. We're like, yeah, we're using a newer one that's better. And it's, but hasn't been accredited. You know, it's like, and so it was very, I'm curious, like, are you seeing that? Has that changed at all in the last 10 years? Is that?
That, oh man, I'm trying to be optimistic here. I'm trying to look at the bright side of this. Okay. So let's explain the problem you run into. So we'll look at the framework. So NIST 800-53 is a standard NIST framework for how do you do software security. Mm-hmm. We just switched to version 5, right? NIST 853 Rev 5. Well, Rev 4 was released in 2013. What that means is Rev 4 was written based off technology we saw in 2013. And actually, it was started in draft around 2010, 2011. So you're really looking at 2010 technology that gets written into policy. And only in about 2023, 2024, do you start having a revision of that. So you're right. There are really exciting portions of Rev 4 that you look at and go, if I comply with this, I will be incredibly insecure because the world of technology has changed. Right. So this is one of the huge issues is when you have a compliance-built framework for accreditation, then your compliance, the compliance policy can never keep pace with emergence of technology. Just talk to Google. Google had a whole different way of how they shard data, and they don't stick all the data in one data center in one locked facility. And so in many ways, Google's cloud didn't meet the standard expected by the government. It took them years to finally convince DISA and the government that yes, the even though it's different, it meets the intent of being secure. Mm-hmm. Again, that's different as opposed to like Microsoft and AWS that stuck their data centers on facilities that they could say, yep, all your data is in one spot and it's surrounded by a guy with a gun. And so, yeah, that's a huge issue of keeping up with those standards. So that's why for us, we try to do that on their behalf and then still try to offer up modern tooling and modern processes that still comply within that framework. But from a commercial vendor standpoint, when they look at what we're offering, they're like, oh yeah, I've used those tools before. Those are current modern software development tools I feel comfortable with.
Are you seeing that on the compliance side that they're being like these standards that are being written, are they being written more abstractly, more on the spirit of like what the intent of these things are rather than being so explicit about you need to be using one of these handful of things that we know 2 years from now is going to be no longer relevant?
I'll give a short answer and then she'll let you. I think they're getting better, and there's a couple ways you look at this. So DoD CIO's office has actually been putting out new guidance for continuous ATOs. That's a relatively new model where security is less about based off of filling out spreadsheets of control maps against risk management frameworks. It's actually more about continuous monitoring, continuous assessments, which is exactly where we should be going. And then the biggest one, the Army CIO last week or early this week put out great guidance on how to secure things in the cloud. Like, it is one of the best memos I've seen. It's like 28 pages. I don't know.
Said no one ever.
Well, if you're into this sort of thing, it's kind of cool. So I think you're seeing a real change. And the Air Force, I think, really took the lead on this.
That's awesome.
Continuous ATOs. But, you know, there's a movement now, and I think it's going in the right direction.
I like how Enrique talked around the fact that he was kind of on the ground floor helping make all these things happen, the continuous ATO. When he was still at DIU transitioning to Kessel Run, this was a story told to me by one of the auditors who's now at AppWorks. But there was a huge pushback against the continuous ATO process because the static RMF, the static ATO, the way ATOs were done beforehand, that we knew, like us as tech people knew, we were exposing ourselves to massive amounts of security vulnerabilities just because you got an ATO. That means this SES said you were secure on that date and time, and you probably were per what was known at that date and time. But then all these 0 days are discovered, and turns out that thing's got more holes than Swiss cheese. We can't go fix them because the moment we fix them, we break the policy that allows me to use it. So I just have risk. And we do that. We do that all the time. With the when they stood up Kessel Run, they I don't know if anybody was paying attention to how many of the commits that they were committing to back to the core were actually remediating CVEs. But we didn't care, because the whole idea of switching to an agile framework was giving the user what they wanted, sticking to like agile principles. So we're willing to say, when the auditors came in and said, you're exposing yourself to so much more risk by this continuous ATO process, you know, you guys are going to fail miserably. And they were like, well, it's a risk we're willing to take to give the user software they'll actually use and be able to iterate on. It's so worth it just from that perspective. And then when they go and do the evaluation and find it's like the most secure software in the Air Force, because it's getting CVEs remediated, that's when they realize, like, wow, you're giving the user something they want, and you're also actually making it more cybersecure. Yet we don't have a policy to capture that cybersecurity assessment is accurate and valid. And so now, as like the PM who owns the contract with Second Front, we've deplatformed users who haven't, you know, like a new CVE's been discovered and they didn't meet the CVE remediation requirements in time. We're going to bring them back on once they get their code back up to standards. But in the traditional way, oh, they'd still be on the platform. They'd still be pushing. And then we would just have exposed, you know, vulnerabilities. So it has, I think the policy has moved on and we've gotten better. And I really, honestly, Enrique and a handful of other folks from like that early Kessel Run era are really kind of who set those conditions that the rest of us are just, we're standing on the shoulders of giants.
So let's give credit where credit's due on this one, though. So, you know, Mike, you're kind of joking that I said, oh my God, what an amazing Army policy. Policy matters. In the government, policy is, it's like the Bible, you know? And so it's great. Like what we were doing there, it was a lot of like these crazy ideas myself and a few others had. We stole the ideas from U.S. Digital Services. We stole the ideas from NGA with Paul Puckett. We stole the ideas from Leo Garcia at JIDO. And it's great that I have ideas, and I sold them as deep as PowerPoint. And like I'm like going around like evangelizing this new model based off of really colorful PowerPoint slides with memes. But it actually took someone, in this case, a guy named Brian Kroger, to actually take that and turn it into an Air Force policy that you can show to leaders and get somebody to sign. Like that's. And that's what matters, because there's all this innovation out there that's absolute theater. Because until it is turned into a policy that is now repeatable, it doesn't matter. It's like it never happened. There's just way too much of that in the Department of Defense. And so, yeah, policy does matter, and somebody has to be willing to write that stuff down on paper and get it signed.
No, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah,
we actually had Kroger on the pod talking. He talked a bit more about that Kessel Run story and how it all came to be as well. I mean, it's really an excellent example of how, you know, you fall into the Second Front company and it's just an organic kind of next step for you, given the Kessel Run backstory. I want to get a little bit more granular, and we talked about this briefly, Enrique, in our discovery call, but you know, trying to, you know, simplify a little bit more for, you know, maybe these, you know, some founders that listen to our podcast that, you know, are breaking into the defense space, or maybe they're working with a consultant or an advisory firm to help, you know, position themselves, maybe a dual use scenario or something like this. But walk me through like what a, you know, how Second Front is working with these companies from, you know, the different phases, like discovery, and how, you know, you don't have to get too deep into the weeds of it, but I'd love to hear just a little bit more of like how does these engagement, how they flow?
Yeah, so I think the engagement actually, it kind of has two halves. So the first half is obviously what we do with the government first. Like, how do we make sure that the platform we deploy, the tooling we have, the reports that the tools generate, how do we make sure it meets what the government cares about and what they need to see? And that's kind of an evolving process. Is, you know, different accreditors, different security officials want to see stuff slightly differently. As time goes on, it's one of those things like there's the expectation always increases. It's like, sure, that was secure last quarter, but how about this quarter? What else have you added to give us a higher level of assurance? So there's as we as a company are delivering to the government, we are constantly having to engage. I think, and this is very different than, you know, there's other ways to deliver to the government. There, you can provide services where it's just like you're just butts and seats, your bodies for the government to use at will. You know, that is not our model. We provide a technology. But the thing is, we're providing our technology. What we're not doing is we didn't build a technology based off of the government giving us 800 pages of technical specs saying, please build this widget. And so what's happened is because we built it to what we think is the right thing to do, it ends up becoming a continuous negotiation with the government. Like, does this meet your standards? Do you want to see it differently? Do you want to see something else? And so it's a constantly evolving process of what our technology looks like. And so that's our government relations. But then the other side of the house, like we talked about, is working with the commercial side. So for commercial companies that want to work with the government, that engagement really starts with us doing like a tech screen saying, you know, what is your app look like? How is it built? What's your tech stack? What toolings are you using? What cloud services are you using? What external connections do you have? And we really kind of do an assessment saying, does it fit our model? Because at the end of the day, I love our platform, but I'm a firm believer that there's no one solution for everything. There are definitely some use cases of technologies that I'm sorry, our platform, it's not compatible for you. I wish it was, but that's not how technology works. There's software that is so advanced using so many advanced underlying cloud features. Like there's no way we could support that because it's well beyond what an accreditor or policy would feel comfortable with. At the other end, there's these technologies that are like, man, you're like nowhere close to being cloud native or containerized. It's going to take you a year to refactor, to work with us. So we try to cover like the core center of the bell curve of modern app development, containerization. So we do a tech screen. Then once we bring the company on as a customer, we start off by like, we just take their containers. We don't take their code. We take their containers. We scan them against a bunch of security tooling. We run hardening scripts against it to minimize, you know, basically STIG and minimize the container images and all the root accounts and extra libraries. And then we throw them up into a dev cluster, make sure the stuff works. We have a full observability stack and login and monitoring. So we make sure performance is there. And then we work with it to deploy out into our environment where we force an integration with our IDAM solution, force an integration through our networking paths, our observability stack, our security stack. And that's actually what allows them to inherit our accreditation or be given a certificate to field off our accreditation, is because they're using all of our tooling that has already been accredited. And that's what makes it work. So, you know, for a company that's considering this kind of model, you know, the downside is you lose a little bit of control in prod and a little bit of architecture design of saying, you know, your engineers cannot be as creative as they want to be. But on the positive side, you actually don't have to have as many infrastructure engineers. You don't have to have the compliance team. You don't have to have the 24-hour monitoring team because we're covering all that for you. So it's a business and technology trade-off for that company saying, do they want to go it all themselves and have full control? Or do they want to give up a little bit of control on those day two ops for the fact that you can go faster and have a quicker to market?
And I feel like that's just the same old, like in the technology world, the build versus buy type discussion. Like what's our core competency? And having lived through that, where we actually had to hire a full-time person who was going to be sort of trying to deploy the stuff at the government and various intel agencies and like trying to figure out how we take what we did in the cloud at AWS and how are we going to get this deployed into these data centers. And luckily we didn't use AWS, like we're cloud agnostic, but it's still a pain. So yeah. I see the value. I mean, I would have loved to have you guys back then. Would have made things so much easier.
Well, when you kick off your next tech company, let us know. We'll
I'll be in touch.
So it's kind of a genius concept. Just knowing the hoops that you have to jump through, you kind of cut out all that legwork for them. But it sounds like a kind of continuous iterative delivery for them too. Kind of given how always changing like the policies and the requirements are going to be on the government side. So then when you engage this commercial company and things are kind of kicked off, it's a good fit, you agree to kind of press forward, what's the level of communication? How much back and forth is there between you and that commercial company moving forward? Is it what kind of cadence do you guys connect back and forth, or is it just kind of
Do you want me to show you our Slack channels?
can you?
By the way, I would love to say our Slack channels blow up because they're always happy that we do incredible work, but you guys know how the reality is. Sometimes our Slack channels blow up because something went wrong. But at the end of the day, like we have that kind of literally the day-to-day interaction with our customers and the day-to-day interaction with the government. Like relationships matter. Like, I know everybody says technology, it's an abstraction. You can move away from people. AI can break away from people. No. Like, the relationships are even more important when you're doing something that both for mission has purpose and it's more technologically advanced or cutting edge. Like, you have to have those relationships. And so we try to maintain good relationships with our customers. I hope they would agree if they're listening to this, but you know, if you don't, please let me know on Slack and I'll start to solve it.
Totally agree. I mean, it goes back to, I mean, I'm not trying to plug myself here, but that pairing that I had around trust, right? If I know that you have that you're competent and trust that you know how to secure things, like, that goes a long way when I'm reviewing your security documentation. And I, as opposed to if I don't think that you know, and then I'm going to be looking for, you know, through it more fine tooth. And so the relationships absolutely matter. Yeah.
I'm curious, is there, you know, on the AFWERX side, in connection to Second Front, like, are there specific, you know, metrics that you all are looking at to, you know, it's kind of evaluating the success of the solution?
Oh, yeah. I mean, specific metrics themselves, like, from a, you know, cybersecurity perspective, obviously, those are all well documented. But there's even the onboarding process, like he talked about, you know, there's a relationship there between the two companies, which totally benefits the government in that it's, like, from an engineering perspective, it's B2B, and I'm not getting involved in the middle, which really saves the government a lot of time and headache. But for all of these apps, with rare exceptions, the exceptions being Autonomy Prime, which are also mine, the rest of them are, there's another government personnel involved too. So you've got a government sponsor for the actual app that's getting onboarded. That government sponsor and I will work together and figure out, like, is Second Front the right fit? And then if they are, then that becomes a natural transition path for them. And then the company will start working together. But there's still another government PM involved in all of this. So, which has worked out great, because that government PM, like, I'm focused because of the platform with Second Front. I'm just focused on, like, cybersecurity and compliance and policy. That other PM gets to, he doesn't even have to think about that. He gets to focus on, like, day two ops and prod and, like, adding features and what does his actual user base that he represents, what do they care about? And then that other company gets to focus on that too. So you, it's not, to quote a friend of ours, it's a lot of blocking and tackling, and it's not sexy stuff, but it has to get done. By doing that and abstracting that layer out from the, you know, from the companies that are actually performing, they get to focus on the things that really matter. But that's actually how I ended up at DIU, was I wanted to do that for JTAC software and take the thing that every JTAC in the Air Force has in common, or not in the Air Force, in the DOD, abstract that out, do the unsexy stuff, and then let all program offices focus on what made them unique and special snowflakes. And it turns out, like, that same process needs to happen at a corporate dual use level for everything. We're at now.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And Enrique, you all are probably, you know, getting exposure to so much interesting, you know, companies and entrepreneurs and technologies that are coming through the door. And it's a really, really neat kind of, like, funnel that you all get to play a part in and bridging that gap of, you know, how to add value into the, yep, the larger defense ecosystem. I think, unless there's anything specific that you wanted to tack on in terms of, how this process kind of flows, then we kind of tackled it from a bird's eye view. I don't think we need to get too much more granular, unless there's something there, Enrique, that you wanted to add on as a final takeaway.
Yeah, a final takeaway, and it's less about our process, you know, it's our process. But, like, if you step it back, like, what's the process of a company working with the government? Like, something I did not realize when I was on the government side, I'm like, oh my God, this is so easy. I didn't actually realize the pain we put companies through to work with us. Now that I'm on the company side, I really see what that pain is. And it's incredible. Things like you never think about, like, pieces of paper. Like, there's this magical piece of paper called a DD-254, which is a piece of paper. it's a piece of paper that lets you get access to, like, you're allowed to have access to this facility. You're allowed to have access to this classification, whatever. Shockingly, sometimes getting someone to sign a sheet of paper can take months. And you don't really think about that when you're on the commercial side, like, oh, I got to execute on a contract and I have to get a bunch of people piece of paper signed. Or, like, how do I actually get on a network to see if my product works? You don't actually really think about that when you're delivering to the government, that oh yeah, you actually have to have a government virtualized computer somewhere. And how do you get that kind of thing? Like, there's all these little things that when you're a commercial vendor and you're so excited about submitting for an RFI or putting your proposal in or something, like, what you don't realize is that the hard part is not getting the contract. The hard part is there's so much other bureaucracy after you win the contract, and really none of it's under the control of the program manager that you're working with. It's actually, they're usually just as frustrated because there's all these other rules. Even the simple things like, hey, I need, my team needs ID cards so we can either get on a base or log in. It's like, and then you ask, like, who needs ID cards? And your program managers are like, I don't know. I got my, I don't know how you get yours.
You just described my experience of trying to get onto Aberdeen.
Like, this is stuff that I was on the government side, I never considered, because I'm like, that's just what we do every day. And then you don't realize the commercial companies have no idea how to do it. And when they ask you, you realize, oh, I actually don't know how to do it either. So anyway, that's the fun part of delivery to the government. It's a challenge every day.
Thank you for describing most of my life lately. It's been doing those things. The deeper I get into supporting other warfighters, like outside of my community, the more I found that SOCOM had a pretty well-oiled machine in terms of conventional acquisitions, and the rest of the DoD is not. And yet I don't even exist trying to do the rest of the DoD from a conventional acquisitions perspective. I'm working in a, you know, innovative acquisitions perspective, which is trying to go even faster than SOCOM. But it turns out that that means on Monday afternoon, I'm sitting there with SESs and PhDs talking about real high level stuff. But Tuesday afternoon, I'm going to be working on forms for people to get ID cards and provide access to networks. So I think, I guess, taking 15 drafts of a DD-254 because I'm learning as I do it.
This is the totally unsexy side of defense innovation is paperwork, but it's
there. Oh yeah.
Yeah, and we don't want to sugarcoat it for folks too. I mean, it could be a huge time suck and a waste of time for you to consider, like, you know, really making that pivot down that rabbit hole. And so I think it's an interesting, you know, I mean, you have that level of empathy, Enrique, where, you know, having sat in that and on both sides, it is creating also, you know, there's a lot of opportunities that are being created from like advisory firms coming in and, you know, helping those entities kind of save that time. There's obviously a lot of work to be done. We're having some interesting conversations coming up here soon in a couple of weeks on more of this, you know, government reform and dissecting like the FASA, the Federal Acquisition Streamline Act, because that whole Palantir use case is a fascinating one to kind of pick apart. But there's definitely I would say in the last few years, you know, there's, you know, certainly been a lot of interest building and getting involved in the defense sector. There's been, you know, there's a level of stability that comes with this, you know, with the government as well, where you see a downslide in some of the commercial markets like we've been seeing that, you know, leads to, you know, founders figuring out how to, you know, diversify and become more you know, dual use if the use case exists. But I think this, you know, this is just another episode, another example of, you know, just a small nugget of wisdom on, you know, how some of it's done as a good use case with Second Front. So definitely value the time that you guys contributed to break that down, explain it. And I know we have just a couple minutes left, so I do want to get to the 5-second scramble real quick. I think it's a fun one to just kind of learn a little bit more about you guys as guests. Mike, why don't you kick it off
with Enrique?
And then I'll take Chi.
So here we go. I'm just going to ask you questions.
I'm nervous here.
Don't worry about it. It's a mix of like business questions and then personal questions. You'll be fine. All right. You ready? Explain Second Front to me as if I were a 5-year-old.
You just bought a new toy and you want to play with your new toy, but you can't play with it until your dad spends 8 months filling out pieces of paper that says you're allowed to play with it, and then you can hang it.
Awesome. What type of technologists thrive at Second Front?
Oh man, technologists that have actually served at like the tip of the spear in the military, like if you're like a cutting edge special operator and you like tech, those are the kind of people that thrive, because, you know, it's undefined problems and you just have to solve them. And that kind of, it's the mindset that seems to work. Basically, anybody, anyone who has that kind of mindset is like, I just want to solve problems.
Cool.
Yeah.
What's your favorite part about the culture at Second Front?
I don't think we take ourselves too seriously. We have like a whole meme channel, which is just a blast. And like everything we do is like, there's a lot of like unserious aspects of our day-to-day life, which then compensates for the fact that we have to act serious when we go out in public. So, you know, it's good.
Do you have a chief memes officer? That's what that, a lot of companies I've worked at, we've had that.
We actually do. His name is Dylan Sims. He's a rock star in meme. Yeah.
Awesome. That wasn't one of the ones. Anyway, if you could have 1 hour mentor session with any tech giant, who would it be?
Oh my God. You know, I'll say Kevin Mandia. The work that he has done on Pioneer on security for attribution of adversaries, which again, this is me putting my former military hat on what I used to, like, I love that stuff. Love to sit down and just like pick his brain for an hour on adversary threats.
Cool. Something you did as a kid that you still enjoy?
Was that?
Something you did as a child that you still enjoy.
So, over Christmas, my kids bought me another Lego set. So I still do Legos. Yeah.
Nice. What's a charity or corporate philanthropy that's near and dear to you?
I've been donating for years to an organization called International Justice Mission, which, so IGM actually helps free slaves from around the world. We had a huge slavery issue right now. It's massive. It's all over the world. And so they go out and try to get slaves both through legal systems and through other methodologies like education and then the legal system to get people removed from slavery.
Wow. What's something you love doing but are really bad at?
So I broke my elbow, dislocated it playing soccer because I'm that bad and that clumsy that I fell, but I still love it. It's still a great sport. So there we go.
Cool. Last one, because I know you got to go. What's the most outdated piece of tech you can't let go of?
Well, like most people, I still have like two gigantic boxes of old cabling that I just never know when I might need it. So it's still there.
That's what's in my closet.
Yeah. It's my wife. She's going to kill me at some point. I drag it from place to place. Yeah, I think that's probably it. It's just that's all great. My cables.
Classic.
That's great. Yeah, everybody can relate to that. Freaking drawer of just old cables just sitting there. God knows what they get.
I've got some good SCSI cables. It's awesome.
Oh, I don't have a SCSI. That's awesome.
All right. Yeah. Last few minutes here, Chi. You ready?
Oh, yeah.
All right. So, what is one word you'd use to describe the innovation culture at AFWorks?
Complex.
Well said. What's one emerging technology that you believe will revolutionize Air Force operations?
I could take the cheap way out and say AI, but I think it's actually, it's not so much technology itself. It's going to be the way we ingest technology and changing the way we proliferate it throughout the DoD.
What's the first step that you would advise startups to that are looking to take that next leap to working with the DoD?
First, look internally to make sure you really want to do this. Second, I would say having a while there's a lot of benefit to working with the DoD, especially if you're trying to mature a product, is make sure you have some sort of corporate dual use case in mind, something commercial, because the government is really good at putting a carrot on the end of a string and then leading you really, really far down a rabbit hole before you get paid off. So having like if you're basing your business model and your venture capital on just dealing with the government, it could get very dangerous very fast.
Check that runway. How do you envision the role of software and the Air Force changing over the next 5 to 10 years?
I tried to me and another soft guy sat down yesterday and said we need to update the SOCOM mantra from humans are more important than software, that is more important than hardware. I definitely think software is especially getting involved in big programs now that involve a lot of high-end technology. Software is the most important thing. I get cheap hardware to do all sorts of amazing things, but I need exquisite software to enable those amazing things. So that's why I call myself a software evangelist.
Nice. If you could race any car on any racetrack in the world, what and where would it be?
Oh, the track is I'd probably want to do the Nürburgring. The car would be that's a better question. I would love to lie and say like a modern F1 car, but honestly, I would just like dump the clutch and kill it over and over again. I would probably want something, you know, some exquisite new supercar that I feel like I'd be able to go drive myself.
Nice. What's the name of the first beer that you ever brewed?
Ooh, the first one I brewed. I don't know. That's a hard one. I think the first one I brewed of my own recipe, I've named Dausho, after a Belgian model. My dad calls it the mistake because it's me trying to like merge two recipes of two of my favorite Belgian beers together. And then when it got to brew day, I was missing some ingredients and I had to just make stuff up. And the resulting beer, when I put it on tap months later, I poured a pint for my dad and I was like, I apologize if this is trash, but this is what I had to work with. And my dad took a sip. He's like, this is one of the best beers I've ever had in my life. Please tell me you wrote this down. And I'm like, yeah. So I've now made it numerous times. And if I ever start my own brewery, that will definitely be my flagship beer. It's my own
recipe. Amazing. What is a charity or corporate philanthropy that's near and dear to you?
I've been donating to the Special Operations Warrior Foundation pretty much my whole career. They've done amazing stuff in taking care of the families of fallen operators who and I mean, just in not just financial ways, but intangible ways. You're a high school student and they're going to get you a scholarship, but you're having problem getting grades. They'll reach out to the community and find a nerd like me who loves deep math and tutor those kids before they go off to college. So it's more than just about money. It's about actual connections and keeping those people part of the family. Because we did a call every January on the anniversary of one of my buddies dying, and his wife has since remarried and moved on, and she dials in, and she's got 1,000 older brothers that are still looking out for her. So I love that organization.
Very cool. Yeah, we'll plug both of those in the show notes as well, so build some awareness as well. What was your dream job as a kid?
I probably had it. Honestly, I'm working in an IndyCar team. Was great right up until I did it, and then I was like, "Well, this is a lot more work than I was expecting." And then when I went into the military, my first tick where when things went to hell in a handcarton and in a gun run, and a guy tells me he's going to go home and see his daughter because of me, it was like a heroin hit, and I was chasing dragon the whole rest of my career. And now I'd say this feels like my dream job right now, so much so that as my active duty retirement is around the corner, I'm actually like gonna stay government for a little while as GS, just to get like this program over the line. I'm too like passionately involved. And I think the big reason is that when I was at Fort Bragg doing Fort Bragg stuff there, sorry, Fort Liberty now, I felt like I was solving today's problems right now, and it was great. It was very fulfilling. But now I'm in a position where it's like, hey, go prevent the next 30 years of war, and make it so that the U.S. has a competitive advantage that we haven't even thought about, instead of just refighting the last war over the next fight at 3-5% more efficiently. Because that's traditionally what government acquisitions does.
That's great. Awesome answers all around. You guys passed with flying colors. it's been a pleasure having you both share your experiences with us, and I love the innovation that you're doing it for national security at large. It's definitely inspiring, and grateful for your time, and thank you for your service, and appreciate you all joining us on the pod.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you for having us on.
Yeah, thanks.